Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to the Kimmel Center recital debut of Curtis-trained pianist Yuja Wang. Susan Lewis considers the beginnings, evolution, and contemporary mission of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. Founded in 1824, the Society is now celebrating the centennial of its landmark building in Philadelphia. As part of the companion series to his latest book, Wicked Philadelphia, Tom Keels uncovers a notorious 19th century grave-robbing scandal that reached from the city's poorest to the highest ranks of its medical elite. And we speak with Charles Henry Bethea, executive director of the Baptist Temple at Temple University. Following extensive renovations, the temple has reopened as a state-of-the-art performance and event space and hosts its first concert this evening. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Pianist Yuja Wang has come about as close as anybody can in classical music to waking up famous, though she's not sure how she feels about it. Only a few years ago, she could be heard playing chamber music at the Curtis Institute of Music's intimate Field Concert Hall. Now graduated and 23 years old, she's returning to Philadelphia on Thursday to play the Kimmel Center's large Verizon Hall. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met Wang in New York and found her to be much the same as she was as a student. Outspoken, fun, and not very interested in doing things the way they've always been done in classical music.
One common mistake made by classical music audiences these days is listening to Yuja Wang with their eyes. Many see a young Asian pianist and somehow hear music making that's fast and furious, or observe the difference between her large sound and small fashion model frame, rather than hearing the sound's well-considered quality. Then there's the depth question. Western music was banned in her native China for many years and not heard at all. How could her performances be anything but superficial? But on Wang's new disc, Transformation, the Scarlatti Sonata in F minor is so emotionally vivid, you long to know what was she thinking.
I learned it in China, but just couldn't get right at that time. And every time I start playing that piece, I start smelling my home while I was practicing when I was 14, actually 13, and then that afternoon where I was trying really hard to get it, and it was like raining outside, everything was washed off and clear, but my inner emotions were still kind of struggling.
Shortly after that, the already promising pianist played one last recital in Beijing, moved to Canada to learn English, and then to Philadelphia's Curtis Institute of Music, where she was a surprisingly assured student under Gary Grafman. She made some important debuts, filling in for indisposed Martha Argerich and Murray Pariah, was put under contract by the Deutsche Grammophon label with surprising speed last year, and will make her first concerto recording later this year. The significance of all that isn't lost on her. Particularly gratifying is her ongoing relationship with the elder statesman of Italian conductors, Claudio Abbado. She has performed with him in Lucerne, Bologna, and Beijing.
First of all, I couldn't believe I was like sitting beside this legend when I first met him. And he's really tiny, like he's like my height, just a little higher, and very skinny, he just had stomach cancer. Yeah. And the first thing he's like, I'm a great-grandfather now. It's like so Italian about family, it's totally different from how I would picture him. And he just, like, he was really silent all the time, especially in rehearsals. Like, you want to ask him about how do you feel about this, and nothing happens. Like, everything, all the language goes through his gestures.
This particular season is so busy that she's grateful to have two consecutive days off, or a week in New York, to hang out with her boyfriend, New York Philharmonic trumpeter Matthew Mucky, or to hear Mahler's Symphony No. 2 under one of her favorite conductors, Michael Tilson Thomas. Future seasons won't be that way. Wang knows how to say no. Her parents aren't pushing her career. They didn't even emigrate to America with her. She wants her career to feel something like a hobby.
Once I know piano is like my job, I lose like this secretness, like this fun part. Because when you think, oh, this is my hobby, I want to do it, it's a different attitude.
She reserves the right to change her recital programs and is so serious about it that she recently turned down some concerts in China because she was being told what to play.
I just can't stand the way they do things. Actually, they invited me back to play a recital in July, which I just canceled because I have to play old Chopin and I don't want to. So instead, I'm actually going to play 3 recitals in Taiwan. I'm sure they won't like that. China.
Yuja Wong's new disc, Transformation, strongly reflects her singular personality. It starts where many piano recitals end, with Stravinsky's 3 Dances from Petrushka, one of the hardest pieces in the repertoire, but one that, when done right, is exciting but never gratuitously flashy. From there, she covers a variety of musical eras, not in the usual chronological order, touching down with Scarlatti, Brahms, and Ravel. The odd part is that in performances, the more overwhelmed she is, the better she plays.
Yeah, but I mean, I definitely have this feeling, like, the more I feel really comfortable on stage, it comes off like, yeah, it was good, but nothing special. You know, one of those, it definitely have an opposite. Like, now if I feel uncomfortable on stage, I'm like, okay, I'm fine now.
Certainly, Philadelphia Orchestra Chief Conductor Charles Dutoit does not let her rest. A Scarlatti sonata is one thing, but for that cornerstone masterpiece, the Liszt Sonata in B minor, he sent Wong to the library to research the composer's Faustian inspiration.
She came to see me. She said, you know what, I have to play next week Liszt Sonata. And she was so proud to come and talk about it and relate this sonata with Faust. And I was very touched.
Nonetheless, Wong is haunted by the forthcoming generation of Chinese pianists who have more of a history with Western classical music than she ever did, and thus, in her mind, will have the music much deeper in their subconscious. I'm a lot less worried than she is. Wong has something that a lot of pianists lack, a kind of instinct that can never be taught or inherited or gained by osmosis, and something that's even evident in this recording of her Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra debut in 2003. There's an unaffected directness in her playing, a sense that she's speaking to you in her first language. It's an intangible quality that many young pianists have squeezed out of them by the sheer aggression required by typical career building, the piano competitions, and other high-pressure events that Wong was somehow able to bypass. You could almost wonder if there's some higher forces helping her along and perhaps protecting gifts that she may not fully understand herself.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Yuja Wang performs a recital at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Thursday at 8. The program includes works by Schumann, Schubert, and Prokofiev.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Historical Society of Pennsylvania, which has been accumulating papers, documents, and other historical records since 1824, is this month celebrating the 100th anniversary of its Center City home. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the Society's own story and how it's taking history into the future.
In a locked drawer of a secure vault in a large red brick building on a small corner in Philadelphia rests a diary. It once belonged to Tobias Lear, George Washington's personal secretary, who kept copious notes about, among other things, the details of the last moments of the president's life. Though its binding is worn and its browning pages thin, Historical Society of Pennsylvania president and CEO Kim Sayette can make out the handwritten scrawl.
I feel myself going. Thank you for your attentions, but I pray you to take no more trouble about me. Let me go off quietly. I cannot last long.
Heavily outlined in a box is written,
"He expired without a struggle or a sigh." So while we were fixed in silent grief, Mrs. Washington, who was sitting at the foot of the bed, asked with a firm and collected voice, "Is he gone?" I could not speak, but I held up my hand as a signal that he was no more.
Near the diary lives another journal, this more of a business record.
arrived. John Cannon, old name was London David, 21 years of age, black, tall, rather of a round built.
The journal belonged to 19th century African American William Still, a conductor in the Underground Railroad. This is his detailed record of the people who escaped to freedom through Philadelphia between 1852 and 1857. The vault also contains a first draft of the U.S. Constitution by James Wilson, who would become a justice on America's first Supreme Court, as well as two chalk drawings of William and Hannah Penn, rare glimpses of the images of these Quakers who publicly shied away from portraits. But these are just a fraction of what this building houses, says David Hilgard, Director of Research Services.
In terms of research, these are the most valuable. So we have many, many rooms where we have restricted materials.
The stuff of ordinary lives that changed history has been landing on the Historical Society's doorstep since its founding in 1824. Director of Programs and Communications, Laurie Ciello, says over the next 60 years, as the collection grew, the Historical Society tried different locations, eventually purchasing in 1883 the former home of General Robert Patterson. The mansion, then 50 years old, had a garden, a greenhouse, and a history of entertaining.
Charles Dickens had been here, Ulysses S. Grant had been here, so it was a very well-known mansion. Everyone in the city knew about it. The Historical Society moved in, stored its collection here, opened as a library, and although the mansion was very beautiful, it wasn't big enough and it wasn't fireproof.
And so changes were made. Wings were added, including a large assembly hall to the west. And in the early 1900s, when these weren't enough, the Historical Society renovated the entire inside. The new building, much as it looks today, opened in 1910. With its soaring ceilings, decorative molding, original mantelpieces, and paintings on the walls, the ground floor has retained the traditional elegance of a mansion. Less obvious are certain features designed to protect against things like fire.
Here are one of the chairs from the original building, so if you can hear. It's not wood. It's made of metal.
Oh my goodness. They look like wood chairs.
Yeah, the bookcases in the assembly hall, they are all made of metal. What looks like wooden crown molding, none of it is wood. Everything is painted metal.
And in a feature right out of a James Bond movie, sliding doors.
We have these that separate the different rooms in the Historical Society and the vaults. And if the temperature gets up to a certain level, a metal plug melts at the top of the door, and it drops, and these doors will automatically close. It was very state-of-the-art at the time.
While the Historical Society initially collected objects as well, including a music stand owned by Benjamin Franklin and the wampum belt believed to have been given to William Penn by a Lenape tribe, in the early 1990s, the Society decided to focus on its mission as a research library and gave the objects to the Atwater Kent Museum. In 2002, the Society merged with the Balch Institute, which added to its collection of immigrant history about 4 million more items. Today, the collection includes over 21 million physical items from both famous and ordinary people. Some that belong to the Historical Society, some held in trust for other organizations.
So, for example, we have a huge amount of sheet music through the ages. We have the photo morgue, as they call it, of the Philadelphia Record, one of the major newspapers in Philadelphia. We have recipes that people have kept, menu cards I've seen, family snapshots, letters. It really does run the gamut.
Because the Historical Society is a research library and not a museum, most people who walk through the door are scholars, genealogists, or family historians. But today, the Society is also reaching out to a larger public. Matt Shoemaker is project director for the Digital Center for Americana, which is currently digitizing parts of its 51 Civil War collections.
One of the main things we're trying to do is make our collections more accessible online. We're going to have digital signposts, which are select images that have been digitized in certain collections to give researchers a better idea of the kinds of things they'll find in a collection if they come to use it.
Another online project is Philaplace, an interactive website that maps and annotates neighborhoods of Philadelphia. The project has started with the riverfront neighborhoods historically known as Southwark and Greater Northern Liberties. Project coordinator Melissa Mandel says as populations changed, many buildings were adapted for reuse.
They may have started out as a very small Jewish synagogue in the 19th century, then it turned into a German Catholic church, and then as that population maybe scattered or moved to another neighborhood, it's now an African-American Baptist or Protestant church. That's really common, and of course, with Northern Liberties, seeing the transformation of industrial spaces into housing or artist lofts or studios, the traces of the history are still in the landscape.
Visitors to the website can click on links to essays by historians or read stories and watch videos about ordinary people.
It used to be a very famous location. It was a hangout corner, and they had two delicatessens there.
People looking for history in Philadelphia may start with the Liberty Bell and the blocks around Independence Hall. But as the Historical Society of Pennsylvania is highlighting, history is all around us, in neighborhood streets, homes, places of business, and houses of worship. Evidence of generations past that have shaped the present and will continue to inform the future.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. To mark the 100th anniversary of its Center City home, the Historical Society of Pennsylvania is hosting several events, including a day of tours on Monday at noon, 2 p.m., 4 and 6 p.m., a special exhibition of reproductions of old photographs, documents, and architectural drawings runs through August 20th. Mention grave robbing and horrors that happened far away, like Burke and Hare, the murderous resurrectionists of Regency Edinburgh, spring to mind. But Philadelphia, one of America's medical centers since colonial days, also has a long tradition of body snatching. Now WRTI's Tom Keels digs up a little-known scandal that shocked 19th century Philadelphia.
On a cold, dark night in December 1882, four men lay in wait outside Lebanon Cemetery at 18th and Passyunk, then one of only two public burial grounds for African Americans. A horse-drawn wagon emerged from the deserted graveyard and turned onto Passyunk Avenue. One of the waiting men stepped into the road and aimed a pistol at the driver.
Halt! Halt in the name of the law!
He was not a policeman, but a reporter making a citizen's arrest of four grave robbers and their night's haul of six corpses. Louis McGargy of the Philadelphia Press had just broken the story of his career, a decade-long body-snatching scandal that would traumatize the city's medical elite and its black community. Yet according to Roger Lane, professor emeritus of history at Haverford College, this horror occurred during
the golden age of black Philadelphia, the decades just after the Civil War.
Philadelphia had the largest, wealthiest, and best-educated African-American community of any city in the country. But most of the city's blacks were still victimized by their relative poverty, limited opportunities, and the inescapable racism of the era.
In the 1880s, this was a segregated city. Thus, the two cemeteries, Olive at Belmont and Girard, and way down in South Philadelphia, 19th and Passyunk, Lebanon Cemetery.
A decent burial at either Lebanon or Olive offered blacks the last chance to obtain the dignity and peace they had been denied so often during their lives. Yet even in death, they were not always safe from predators. The city had two major medical schools, Jefferson Medical College and the University of Pennsylvania, and numerous private academies. They all needed bodies for their students to dissect, but there simply weren't enough unclaimed corpses from the prison and workhouse to go around. That's why journalist Louis McGargy became suspicious of Jefferson's endless supply of cadavers, all African American.
He was doing a piece on anatomical research when he discovered, hanging around late one night at Jefferson, a wagon with, as he put it, a number of dark bodies in it. And he was very curious where these bodies might be coming from, but there were only two possibilities.
It had to be either Lebanon or Olive. But McGargy had to wait. The spring term was ending, and as he put it, the school's pickling vats were filled to the brim with bodies. He didn't inform the police of his suspicions because he didn't want to lose his story. He had to wait until November of the fall term for another late-night delivery to Jefferson.
And he was able to trace the wagon which made the delivery, and the people who were driving the wagon. He was able to swear out a secret warrant for the arrest of these grave robbers.
Once the grave robbers were arrested, the full horror emerged. Lebanon superintendent, an African-American named Robert Chu, was the leader of a team of ghouls who had stolen hundreds of bodies from the cemetery over the previous decade. All were sold to Jefferson Medical College for dissection, at $8 a corpse. The next morning, the city morgue was mobbed by blacks trying to identify the six recovered bodies. Others raced to Lebanon, desperate to discover if their loved ones were still resting in peace.
One woman was crying. She had just raised $22 begging down on the docks to bury her husband, and she discovered that the body had been taken. A man who had the day before buried his brother was down there in tears and in a fighting mood.
But Philadelphia's whites remained unmoved by the Lebanon scandal until one of the grave robbers named the man who had accepted and paid for all those corpses, William S. Forbes, head demonstrator of anatomy at Jefferson. F. Michelangelo, university archivist at Thomas Jefferson University, explains that
he was a major figure in Philadelphia, a very respected physician. Forbes was very well renowned as an anatomist. He actually trained in the Crimea under Florence Nightingale, and she presented him with a set of instruments. She was so very impressed by the young man.
Now, shockwaves rippled through the city's white medical elite. William S. Forbes seemed like the last person to knowingly accept illegally obtained corpses.
Dr. Forbes, along with the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, passed the 1867 Anatomy Act, which provided bodies, people who died at public expense, to medical colleges for dissection.
When Forbes was brought to trial, he took the stand in his own defense and testified that he had never knowingly accepted an illegal corpse. He denied ever entering the dead room, where corpses were received and prepared at Jefferson. Forbes was completely exonerated in the Lebanon Cemetery case. The four grave robbers, on the other hand, received jail sentences ranging from 4 to 24 months. When Forbes entered his classroom at Jefferson the following Monday, the entire student body and faculty were there to give him a standing ovation. But Jefferson archivist Michelangelo is not convinced of Forbes' innocence.
My feeling was perhaps he did know, and perhaps like other men in Philadelphia in his same position at University of Pennsylvania or Medico-Chirurgical College, they just didn't want to know all the details because they really had to have at least 50 bodies per year for the students, otherwise the educational system would collapse.
After his trial, Forbes authored a new, more stringent anatomy law that required all state institutions to give medical schools the unclaimed bodies of their dead inmates. Before Forbes died in 1905, an honored and respected physician, his portrait was painted by Thomas Aikens. Despite the grave-robbing scandal, Lebanon Cemetery lasted almost as long as William S. Forbes. In 1903, the city purchased the site, and all of its bodies were removed to Eden Cemetery in suburban Collingdale.
WRTI's Tom Keels. Read more about the Lebanon grave-robbing scandal in his latest book, Wicked Philadelphia, Sin and the City of Brotherly Love, published by the History Press. Our final item this morning takes us out of the studio and into the Baptist Temple, the building for which Temple University is named. And it's just undergone a 2-year, $30 million plus renovation to make it a multi-use performance venue. It's quite awe-inspiring. Standing with me is Executive Director Charles Henry Bethea. You've already had a couple of sort of trial runs, but this weekend sees the first concert proper.
Well, we're always anxious to see the facility in use as a public facility, and we have had a couple of quasi-events, if you will. We've had some open rehearsal situations with some of our musicians from Boyer College, and we've had an opening gala and opening ribbon cutting and things of that nature where actually we've had public in the building. But this is the first event that people actually are buying a ticket to, and coming in and sitting down in a seat that's listed on their ticket to hear a very high-end, high-level musical performance. So I'm looking forward to it with a great deal of anticipation from several points of view. One is, of course, how do we work in terms of the place where audiences will enjoy those performances, but also how is that performance going to be in terms of the musicians on the stage.
Acoustically, the room sounds very bright. It's a 1,200-seater in the round. I guess nobody's further than about 10 rows back when the stage is extended fully to accommodate an orchestra. That's going to be one of the key issues, the acoustic.
Well, it is, but we so far, everyone is ecstatic about that. As you describe, if you're standing where we are on the stage, I believe the furthest seats may be 20 or 25 feet away. That's not very far. And above us is one of the unique design features of the Baptist Temple, which is the acoustical cloud, which is a rigging array which includes all the lighting and sound trusses, but also has a reflector which can be tuned and positioned according to the acoustical needs of the room.
At 1,200 seats, it's nicely positioned in between, say, I don't know, a Perelman at 600 and something like the Academy or the Kimmel Center, which are in excess of 2,000. That said, how easy is it going to be to convince audiences to come to North Philadelphia to see events here?
I think it's going to be a process of confidence building and trust building. And we all understand that the reputation of North Broad Street is longstanding, and for good reasons many years ago. A lot has changed. You know, this is a pretty friendly place up here. Temple is a pretty friendly campus, and this area is not at all like it was in the days that everyone remembers. What we want to do is to use the success of our program and the success of the venue to build that confidence back with other audiences. Start by building audiences right here. We have a great built-in audience of 20,000 people right here on this campus at certain times of the year. We have a community right around us who live here. Now, obviously, there is a rich variety of opportunity in Philadelphia to see and hear the arts on every level. And so, you know, someone is not going to exclusively come here and quit going to Kimmel Center, and we wouldn't want them to. But by the same token, if we're putting something here at the Baptist Temple that someone would like to hear that might not be somewhere else, we'd also want them to feel really comfortable and optimistic about coming up here. And that said, we have formed a partnership with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia for next year as a way to kind of just introduce our venue to the broader audience out there. So there are a number of ways to do this, but I think patience is the virtue here.
With any new performance venue, there's clearly a steep learning curve for the person who's programming it. What does the audience nearby want? Where can you bring audiences from outside of the direct area? What are your thoughts on the type of programming you'd like to see in here?
I think we want to find our own space and place for what we do. So this is, as you know, as is characterized in its official title, this is an event center for the university. We're going to make it available to university arts and university scholarly activities. That's certainly part of our plans for using it. As far as what we do that looks like what everybody else does, my phrase, which I've used a lot now, is that we want to kind of walk between the raindrops a little bit. We need to just be mindful of the great programming that takes place in our friends' venues around town.
Your competitors' venues.
Our competitors' venues. And then just, you know, how can we fill that in to enrich it? How can we provide something that maybe doesn't get provided on a day-to-day basis somewhere else? So, for instance, in addition to the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, I'm bringing in, I call it kind of the variety pack, a solo pianist, a one night of non-traditional Shakespeare theater, Bayanihan Philippine Dance Company, which is a big, colorful multinational group, and then some New Orleans brass music and some Cuban jazz. So it's completely across the board. And part of that is to keep the flavors interesting. It helps us to test both our immediate audience, the people that we're really going to try and cultivate here, and also how we can build out from there. And more importantly, how we can add and contribute then to the richness of the artistic fabric of the city.
Charles Henry Bethea, Executive Director of the Baptist Temple at Temple University. The Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia, with soprano Heidi Grant Murphy, baritone Nathaniel Webster, and the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, performs Robert Sierra's Missa Latina at Lou Klein Hall at the newly renovated Baptist Temple on the campus of Temple University this evening at 8. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.